So I wasn't planning on this when I first started this when I did Father's Day sermon, but here I am doing Father's Day part two. So, and we're just sort of extending it a week, and you know, per really Bev's encouragement in many respects, I thought, well, maybe it is important that I finish it. So last week, you know, we spent some time on, and I like to do this, especially when the topic is involved. I, as a pastor, I can no longer assume that most people in the church understand the importance of a particular thing. I can no longer, it's not that people are ignorant or whatever, it's just that, you know, churches change. People come in, you don't know what they know and what they don't know. And we do live now in what we call a post-Christian culture. It's no longer a Christian culture, it's a post-Christian culture. And the amount of education, Christian education, that takes place in the life of the average churchgoer has been significantly diminished because of, you know, how the culture's changed and our responsibilities. Used to be nobody worked on a Sunday. Now people work on a Sunday. Used to be that you didn't do a lot of stuff on Sunday. Now, you know, you got to do a lot of stuff on Sunday. So Sunday school and all those kinds of things have sort of gone by the wayside, haven't they? And then the church for a while there, for about 20 years, switched to things called small groups. And because people found that there were some evenings free or whatever. Now there are fewer and fewer evenings free, and small groups have sort of gone by the wayside a little bit. So it's becoming increasingly more and more challenging to educate people in the church. So so I spent the whole Sunday, most of the Sunday, on what I would call rhetoric. This is what we want to talk about, and this is why it's important. This is what we want to talk about specifically. You define it, and this is why it's important. And then once I talk about why it's important, then I talk about what it is, and sort of like the biblical approach to a particular thing, or, you know, as I see it. So Father's Day is, you know, it's not one of those things where you can look in the Bible and say, oh, yeah, the Bible says this about Father's Day. It doesn't do that. But the Bible does say some things about the institution of the family and about the office of what it means to be a father. It does talk about that. And so, you know, per the passage of Scripture that Bev read this morning, or the two passages of Scripture that she read this morning, it's this really powerful text that talks about what they used to believe back then, that if the fathers were judged because of the sin in the lives of the fathers, that the children's lives would be judged as well. In other words, it was a corporate punishment that oftentimes impacted the life of a family because of what the father or what the mother did or did not do. There's a thing called generational sin, by the way. I don't know if you've ever heard of that term, but and I think there's something to it. That have you ever noticed that if the grandfather was sort of a bit of a philanderer in his marriage, that the son was a philanderer and the son's son was a philanderer, and it just seemed like there's this thing that follows them, you know? And so we call that generational sin, and that part of the father's responsibility in Christ is to break the generational sin that they may have inherited. Or the mother, but we're talking about fathers right now, you know, that there's a good thing that you can wake up in the morning and say, I saw this, I experienced this, and I do not want this to be a part of my son or my daughter's life, and I'm going to do whatever I have to do. And so I'm just going to go back and say, he doesn't know I'm going to do this, but I'm going to point it out and say that's what Fred Ashbaugh has done. I mean, Fred struggled with what he struggled with. And Fred, he struggled with what he struggled with because it was passed on to him. And then he struggled with it for a bit. And then he said, this is what he said, because he said these words to me: I love my wife and I love my children, and I do not want this to destroy my relationship with them and to destroy them. And so he did what he had to do to break that cycle. Amen. And if any of you have ever seen Fred with his children, you can see how much he loves them and how devoted he is to them. So that's really kind of, in many respects, what this text is about. It's about that there is grace, there's mercy, there are possibilities. We don't have to be in bondage to what our parents hand down to us. We don't have to be in bondage to that. That God can work, can break that. Looking at Marianne. Marianne, I saw you nodding at me because your father struggled, didn't he, with alcoholism. And you don't, and Joey doesn't, because you made a choice, didn't you? You know, that you would not allow that to be a part of your life. So, but there is this truth, is there not, that the fathers eat the sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. That you know, sometimes we inherit those things from our parents that are debilitating and destructive and bondage-making, and we need to break it. And if we don't, then our teeth are set on edge. That's what happens to us. So, yeah.
Have you seen the movie The Shack?
I have not seen the movie The Shack. I have ambivalent feelings about, sort of conflicted feelings about it, but there's that thing there. Go ahead and tell me what you were going to say.
Well, there's a generation of physical abuse.
Yeah.
From father to father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And that's really one of the beautiful parts of that story, is how he figured out a way to move from being a victim to being a survivor. And so let me just say, that's part of the, what we call part of the nomenclature, part of the language of that particular culture. That's what nomenclature means, a language associated with a particular kind of culture. But in the abusive culture, you have those two dynamics. You have survivorship and you have victimization. And that oftentimes what happens is that children who emerge from there choose whether or not they will be a victim of their circumstances or whether or not they will be a survivor of their circumstances. And, you know, I would have to say that my experience has been it's less than 50% of the people who choose to be survivors, rather than who define themselves, you know, as survivors rather than victims in that regard. I would have to say that would be my observation. And so I want to say this. If you could, Sarah, on the next slide. The fathers and father figures have a responsibility then for breaking damaging family cycles that are inherited. So I'm looking at all the men in this room and I'm saying to you, you have a responsibility to break the family cycles that have been handed on to you. If you love your wife, if you love your children, if you love your grandchildren, then you will make that painful journey, and it's painful, to do what you need to do to make your children's lives better, and that we don't hand down to them whatever pathology might have been handed to you. And that not only that, but fathers are responsible for breaking the destructive cultural cycles that we are immersed in. Now, what do you think I mean by that? I'm saying that the culture itself passes on to people and on to families really destructive cycles, and that it's the father's responsibility. Mothers too. But I can tell you, as a man in my family, there have been numerous times that say, oh no, we're not doing that. That's not coming into this house. We aren't going to do those things. That person doesn't get to say that. My family's not going to be impacted by these. In fact, I'm going to speak out against it. That's what I'm going to do. And so I, as a father and as a husband, I feel a responsibility that whatever the culture says, this is okay, this is good. And I look at the scriptures and I say, that's not what the scriptures say. That's not what the historic traditional Christian faith says in terms of orthodoxy. It doesn't say that. This is running counter to that. And as a man, no, we're not going to do that. And so in that sense, as a father then, I need to be protective. I need to be the person that that brings that kind of security to my home. Does this make sense to all of you?
Yes.
And so I've locked horns over the years with any number of people over this issue. And I'm a nice guy, right? And I'm laid back and all that kind of stuff. But there are certain things that you cannot do and that you can't say that's normal or that's good or that's positive or that's healthy. So whether it's pop culture, whether it's the news media, whether it's the educational system, whatever it is, I have to be on guard and I have to take the responsibility of breaking or preventing what the culture wants to pass on to my family and declare as normative and healthy. I'm the one that has to. So I know, you know, for some people that makes me look like a bit of a curmudgeon. I don't care. Yeah.
I remember one time we were on a plane and a gentleman around us, we had our five kids with us, we were flying, and a gentleman on the plane near us was using terrible language. And Al tapped the guy on the shoulder, I think, and said, "Sir, my family is on this plane. I don't want them to hear what you're saying."
Yeah.
And I was so embarrassed.
Yeah.
But also I was so proud that he was protecting us.
Yeah.
Just a foul-mouthed gentleman.
Sure.
You know.
And there's no reason.
That's what was around here.
That's right. And there's no reason for a person to act like that. That's exactly right.
And he made a stand, and God kind of just prompted my heart. That's what a man does.
Yeah.
That's what a godly man does.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So there are these two things then, that both inward and outward, that we as fathers need to take responsibility for. And so last week, and I'm just going to zip through this real fast, because it's important. Look, I got a tremendous amount of response to what I talked about last week. And so I just need to cover this a little bit so that, because on any given Sunday, 1/4 to 1/3 of the people who were in church were not there the Sunday before. So I just try to catch everybody up, you know. So the first thing I talked about was the problem of pop culture father figures. And I use these two guys as examples. They're a little dated. There are other kinds that are that you see on TV now, especially. Go ahead to the next one if you would. But, you know, these two guys here, they are not icons of how you should raise your family, right? And so, and they're... You know, there are more and more dads displayed in our culture like that. As opposed to, say, for example, men like this, you know, that I think do a much better job at representing what fathers should be like. Tony Dungy and Tim Allen. Thank you. I don't know why I did that. But it's right there. I could have read it. So I mean, it was a, you know, I mean, there are two sort of countercultural examples. You know, it's interesting to me, and I know that sometimes he seems like maybe he's gotten better at this, but it's interesting to me how vilified a guy like Tim Tebow is, and how other sort of athletes or media people or whatever. I mean, they would have slept with, you know, 100 women or 1,000 women or whatever. They have kids to I don't know how many different women. And they're like heroes. But a guy like Tim Tebow is vilified. And you just, has the world turned that much upside down? You know? So, now he's not a father, but he is a man of character, I believe. So I did say this, that contemporary fathers and grandfathers, and let me say and uncles today, are culturally portrayed and regarded or expected to be juvenile, irresponsible, self-centered, clueless, simple-minded, polyamorous, oversexed Neanderthals. I mean, that's how they're portrayed on TV. And I'm saying to everyone here, if you are a man, you cannot be this way. And that you have to teach your sons differently, and that you should protect your daughters from men who are like that. Point them out. Hey, look, this is true. Men know men and women know women, right? Isn't that true? And so when your kids are dating, a wife should follow the instinct of her husband in terms of the nature of the man that their daughter is dating. And in most cases, that's true. And in most cases, the husband should respect the instincts of a wife in terms of the woman that their sons are dating, because we just know each other. Isn't that true? I think that's true. All right, number two. I said this, I think this is a thing that fathers, modern day fathers, have to deal with. It's the evolving cultural hatred for maleness in boys. The evolving cultural hatred for maleness in boys. And so fathers and father figures must address this. I mean, there are some men who aren't fathers. They are uncles. And they play a primary role in the life of their nephews and nieces. They are grandfathers. And they play a significant role in the lives of their grandchildren. And they need to address this because this is an evolving and developing and growing thing within the culture in which we live. So I mentioned that we have all heard often and used the word, the incendiary word, misogyny, which means a hatred of women. But have you ever heard the often practiced but hardly ever under word, misandry? Misandry is the hatred of men. And I can promise you that if you go on the average college campus or university campus today, you will see a bunch of misandry. It's in our politics. It's in pop culture, and it's in higher education, particularly in higher education. This idea that men are inherently compromised, and that women represent the better part of the human species. Look, both men and women represent the better part of human species, and both men and women represent the poorest part of human species. Right? There's no one that does it any that's more privileged than the other in that regard. So, but it seems to me that there is this history, this long history, where women were marginalized. That there was a sort of this patristic understanding that men were better and women were worse. That was never a biblical understanding of how God wanted to see men and women. So there was an appropriate response in the world, in the culture, where we wanted to sort of equalize both genders so that men and women were equal but recognized as different. Equal but different. But that's not really where we are today. The pendulum has swung in the other direction, particularly in higher education. And so So these two genders ought to exist in a complementary fashion rather than a competitive fashion. And fathers need to address this. There's a decided drift in the culture today is one of competing genderism. And we shouldn't be competing with each other. We should be complementing each other. Almost any healthy marriage that I've ever seen, the husband and wife understood and recognized the differences that they had, but that they used those differences to complement each other in their marriage relationship. And that's an important thing for a father in particular to be aware of and to convey to their children. But not only that, but the redefinition of maleness really is happening both culturally and scientifically. We are seeing the subjugation of historic traditional maleness into an it-ness. We are moving from maleness to it-ness. And I'm saying that as men and as fathers, that we have to be responsible to protect the biblical understanding of what maleness is and fatherness as it's associated with. Not itness. I am not an it. You are not an it. But that's where we are going. And from the maleness to the itness, it leans very heavily into femininity as opposed to masculinity. So, now again, you got to be careful. At one time, it was considered feminine for a male to have long hair. It was considered feminine for a male to have an earring. It was considered feminine for a male to wear certain kinds of clothes. I mean, we could never, they can't wear a skirt or a dress. But then we didn't know how to what to say about the Scots, for example, right? Because they were running around in kilts. So what do you do with that? But most of the Scots that I've ever met, they were really manly men, but they were wearing the skirt. How do you explain that? So let me just say this too. And this is sort of a rabbit trail, but it's an important rabbit trail to help us to understand and undergird what's going on in the culture and how men need to respond to this. There's this thing called sameness and pan-unipolarism, and I'll just talk about sameness because they're almost synonymous. Pan means all, una means the same, polarism means two opposite extremes. And so what the term means is that there's this move within the culture of taking anything that seems to be on opposite extremes and blending them and making them one. All right? So, but there's this thing that's going on, that this is the idea, that when there are no longer any potential offensive and exclusionary distinctives made, because there's power involved, economically, ethnically, ideologically, particularly as it relates to religion, and with genders, that when those distinctions are erased, then fairness, justice, equality, and true community can be achieved, and lasting peace made possible. This is the progressivist ideal. The blending of everything. So they would say, for example, in religion, all religions are basically the same. You know, they're all, which is, so why are you guys fighting over these particular distinctives? It doesn't really matter. Islam is a religion of peace. The Christian faith is a religion of peace. Hinduism is a religion of peace. Well, no, it's not. I mean, it's different. Everyone goes to heaven. You know, God is gracious and good, and no one is excluded from. Well, yes, they are, you know. And so when you begin making these kinds of distinctions, then it offends people and it gets them angry and mad. And so they say, shh, don't do that. Don't you see that if you don't make these wild distinctions, then everybody gets along and we can have true peace. And you say, but it's a lie. Doesn't matter. Don't you understand that males and females are the same in every way? No, they're not. I've lived with my wife for 32 years. I'm telling you, okay, we are not the same, right? And we're not the same because it's genetics. It's God-given genetics. And they are the kind of genetics where God has placed upon me and her the burden and the task and the goal of learning how to complement each other in our different genetics. Not to compete, to complement each other. But the progressivist ideal is this. Let's just flatten the playing field for everybody. And then we can have true peace. Because as soon as somebody says, I'm unique and I'm distinct, then you're saying, you're better or I'm better. You're worse or I'm worse. That's what you're saying. No, I'm just saying I'm different. So then there's this thing, and this is where I spent a good bit of time last week. I talked about misandry, the hatred of men, and the practice of psychotropic drugs in the lives of boys. And I'm just going to go through this fairly fast, but some of you weren't here, and you need to hear this. According to many parents, educators, and social scientists, these boys that I'm going to show you are non-risk adverse boys that ought to be on mind-altering psychotropic drugs. And so just these pictures real fast. You saw them last week. But for many people, there's something wrong with these boys. Go ahead, Sarah. So there's something wrong with this little boy right here, right? Or the next one. See, they are not risk adverse. They're risk takers. And boys tend to be more risk takers than girls. Because we have this thing in us called testosterone, okay? That's why we do that, right? We're just more risk adverse because we have testosterone in us. It's not estrogen, it's testosterone. And so we tend to be more that way. And so social scientists and educators are like, yeah, but that's not healthy. That's how we discover things. That's how we explore. That's how a lot of physics have been discovered, right? Because of those kinds of things. So just real quick. In this article called The Drugging of an American Boy, by the time they reach high school, nearly 20% of all American boys will be diagnosed with ADHD, one-fifth. of the millions of those boys will be prescribed a powerful stimulant, e.g. Ritalin, to normalize them or to make them to conform. A great many of those boys will suffer serious side effects from those drugs. The shocking truth is that many of those diagnoses are wrong, and that most of those boys are being drugged for no good reason, simply for being boys. It's time we recognize this as a crisis. He goes on to say, the same guy, he says, you know what, this is, and he's a world-renowned psychiatrist. He says, really what the issue is for most of these boys is the lack of a father in their life. I'm not going to read those other two quotes, but he says it's the lack of a male figure in their life, and that's why they do what they do. The male figure is not a healthy figure, or the male figure is absent entirely. And so those boys act out in this kind of a way. There's this wonderful commercial I saw years ago where, and I thought there was really something to this, where villagers in many places of Africa were experiencing rampaging elephants that would get into their gardens that they used to live off of, and they would raid the gardens and destroy a lot of crops, and so they would have to shoot these male elephants. And then they discovered that in the herds where there were older, more mature male elephants, they controlled the behavior of the junior male elephants. So if you shot the senior male elephants and killed them, they no longer had that control. And so the elephants would act out, and they didn't have an older male making them behave. I thought, well, there have been, and I can just tell you again, as a youth minister who, and I have worked with and I have employed other youth leaders, males and females. And males respond differently to adult females than they do males. I'm not being a sexist. I'm just telling you my experiences. And so I could have a young woman stand in front trying to get control of a group of students. And it's like, you know, over here, Sister Mary Elephant. Remember that? Class, shut up! You know, and then they'd shut down. And it's sort of like that. But the truth is, I could stand up and go, hey, it's enough, and boom. And she would look at me and go, I hate that about you. But it was true. And I can tell you in the lives of my own boys, and Jordan's here, and he will tell you the same thing. They responded differently to their mother than they responded to me. Okay? And so there is a time when kids need the nurture and the care and the love and all that kind of stuff that they get from their mom, and there is a time, particularly with boys, when they need a strong male figure in their life to say, you can do this, but you can't do that. And I'll make that happen, not because I have psychotropic drugs in my hand, but because I'm your father. And I would say that, you know, that grandfathers and uncles can play a huge role in the lives of their... we have a group of kids that come over in back of the house. And... they are unsupervised. And sometimes they do really wacky things back there, like they climb up on the swingy thingy. And, you know, we've been having some issues, so I've been addressing those kids. But they don't have father figures. And so in whatever way I can be, I kind of have to be a father figure, you know. Jordan is kind of a father figure to them. So number three, I think that fathers have an added responsibility, more so than they've ever had, of restoring a biblical idea of what masculinity is in our culture and teaching their sons and daughters what masculinity is. If you're a grandfather, if you're an uncle, if you're a father, if you're a brother, you have a responsibility of modeling and restoring what a biblical idea of masculinity is. And this is, look, this, there's just tremendous pushback in our culture on this. Tremendous. It's offensive to talk about what is truly masculine or truly feminine in our culture, even though it runs against what the Bible has to say about it. So I did mention this last week, and I want to mention it again. Isn't it interesting under progressivism that masculinity and femininity are taught as cultural constructs and not determined biology? But transgenderism and homosexuality are biologically determined and are not social constructs. You see this, don't you? Now, how is this possible? All right, it's only possible because it has to fit the narrative that the people who are in control and power want it to fit. And so that's the argument that they make. So what is a biblical view of fatherhood? Children were expected to identify and participate in the nature of their father, to take on his attributes and represent him through their lives. I would say the same should be true for their mother, but I'm just saying biblically that it began particularly in the Old Testament, as they talked about it, that for a child to act in such a way that robbed the father of honor, they endangered the entire family. Because if it was perceived that you could not control your kids, then it also implied that you weren't instructing them, that you were not strong, that you were not a man of character. And why would I want to associate with you or do business with you if you were all those things? And so children who misbehaved or could not be controlled oftentimes endangered the very well-being and welfare of the entire family. That's exactly right. So when you hear like, oh, they're a chip off the old block, that's exactly what they were expected to be.
Okay, so yep. Lay that over where Cain and Abel.
Yeah.
Don't go the way of Cain.
Exactly.
When I read that, I think, what does that mean?
Yeah, because Cain killed Abel, right? Because Cain was jealous, he was spiteful, he was undisciplined. He didn't love God in the same way that his brother Abel did, and so don't go in the way of Cain. Don't reflect what Cain was in that regard. So if your child acted out in that way, then people in the community would assume that you were that way, and because everything was like on a barter system during that time, then why would I trust my word or trust their word? Why would I barter? Why would I risk? If I look at their kids, they must be like that too. Now that's not always fair, is it? I mean, because as parents, you can do everything right. Ted Bundy, the mass murderer, rapist mass murderer, had wonderful parents. I mean, I think he probably genetically was a psychopath. And so you have to factor those kinds of things in, but as a matter of principle. But let me just say this. There is a difference between expecting your kids to represent your family well in the way that you represent your family. There's a difference between that and living vicariously through your kids. Right? There is a difference between those two things. And we're not very good at making that distinction oftentimes, but there is a difference. You know what it means to live vicariously through your children, right? You live your life through them. So whatever success they have, that's your success, right? And so it's unhealthy in many respects to be that way. It's not bad to be proud of your children. It's just that your sense of self-worth cannot be derived by their performance. Your sense of self-worth has to be innate in you. You know who you are and what you're about. And so regardless of what your kids do or don't do, you're secure. But there are a lot of parents who aren't that way. They live off the in fact, in suburbia, I've seen this many, many times where there's this deal between parents and kids. I'll give you all this stuff if you perform well and make me proud. I've been the youth minister of a number of wealthy churches, and I saw that at play a lot. And then when their kids crashed and burned later on, they would come talking to me like, well, what happened here? Go fix them. So, well, let's do a little history lesson here first, you know. So a biblical view of fatherhood then in the Old Testament was that he was of unlimited authority over the family. He was to be honored and obeyed. And these were his responsibilities: to love, agape, to love nobly, sacrificially, unconditionally, to care, to be merciful, to be good, to protect. So two of the boys that were out here, I talked to them this morning, they said, just offhandedly, they said, oh yeah, we were out here all like May. He said, was there something going on at the church? And I said, yeah, somebody was selling a birthday party. He said, well, there were lights on in the house around 11 o'clock. I said, what were you doing out on the streets at 11 o'clock? Why are 12-year-old boys out on the streets, 11, 12-year-old, why are they out on the street? I realize this isn't like the urban city, like it's not Ambridge, okay? I get that, right, where I live. But still, could anything good come from an 11-year-old kid being out on the streets at night by themselves, unsupervised? Where was the father protecting these boys? Wasn't there. So father's responsibility is to train and to educate and to discipline. It's not like these are mother's responsibilities, but these were responsibilities that were always identified with the father, biblically speaking, always. To love, to care, to protect, to train and educate, and to discipline. Let me just say a little something about discipline. And I know I'm going over, but I just want to finish this because it's important. Fathers and mothers have to get on the same page about how to discipline their children. You cannot contend with each other about how to discipline your children. You especially can't do that in front of each other, in front of your kids. And so if there's an issue, there has to be good communication about what the appropriate discipline is or what the appropriate reward is or whatever. And parents cannot compete with each other for the love of their children. Did you hear me? Parents cannot compete with each other for the love of their children. Any of you who are like me, where I'm kind of like an empty nester now, Am I not right in what I'm saying? Have you not seen parents compete for the love of their children? So, you know, one of them like does more and the other like buys more and then the kids are in like la-la land. I mean, they couldn't be happier, right? But it's not making for men or women who are good. So look, for those fathers who have eaten sour grapes, we've got to break these kinds of cycles and we have to restore new traditions and new habits. And to do that, fathers have to be aware, communicate certain things, like their bad habits. You have to become aware of how you use your money, why you make your money, how you spend your money, how you give your money. You have to be aware if you're a workaholic or if you're not working enough in terms of providing. You have to be aware of your sexuality. I want to just say this for a second. This culture has done everything possible that it can do to destroy men, young boys, whatever, in terms of their sexuality. I mean, I wish I had more time to go into it with you. But the bondage that many young men are in today in relationship to porn or whatever is it's breathtaking. And it used to be like in the church, you know, you always sort of would gasp in horror and how awful that was. I have nothing but compassion for these guys. Because at the ripe old age of 10 or 11, if not younger, they're being exposed to things that know how to probe and poke at a weakness in a young man's life like nothing else. I just would say this, because I mentioned to you last week that there seems to be that kind of like in our culture this double standard that when a young woman is reaching puberty and she's a little emotional or whatever, we're expected to be compassionate and patient. But when a young man starts to reach puberty, you know, we find out, we conclude right away that he's a pig and that we hope that he gets over his pigginess, you know, by the time he becomes an adult because he just doesn't control himself or whatever, right? I would say that if a woman could spend 1 or 2 days in the body of a 14-year-old boy, you would understand. And you would be disturbed. You'd run for your life, probably. I don't know. But I'm just saying, that in both sexes, what is happening to them in terms of their hormones and all that kind of stuff, it deserves our compassion, our understanding, our grace, our mercy, our guidance, our protection. It just deserves all of that. And that this culture is doing everything that it can to capitalize on those weaknesses in our children's lives and to contort them in ways that are really destructive and painful. And so now we're raising a generation of young men that have spent hours that would turn into days, that would turn into weeks, that would turn into months looking at stuff online that have shaped them. And in many cases, they were given complete permission by their parents to be able to do that. Because it was normal. It was good. So fathers need to be aware then of their attitudes and mindsets. Are they anger? Do they anger easily? Are they patient? Do they have control issues? Are they living out their self-image issues in the lives of their kids? What are they doing in that regard? And I just want to conclude with this. I want to conclude with these dad words that I think are really good, especially when it comes to... These are things that dads should convey to both their sons and daughters. The first one would have to be their self-identity. Do you know who you are? Do you know what you're about? What are your priorities? Can you list them out? Let me help you with that. Let's work through what's most important to what's least important. Let's understand what is truly important versus what is urgent. Because what is urgent isn't always what is important. You only have to have a 5-minute conversation with the average teenager, and they always talk with words that are urgent. And in many cases, if you're a good parent, you're trying to get them to think about what's really important, right? Because what is urgent to them is what their friends think about them, you know, all that kind of stuff. Skills. Do your children have skills? Have you helped them develop their skills? Whatever skills those are. Do you expect certain skills out of them that they are not naturally gifted for? Or have you discovered certain abilities that they have that they just need to be fine-tuned in a way that they have good skills, life skills? I was so proud years ago. There was this family get-together, and there was this sort of imposing figure, a family member that shook both Jeremiah and Jordan's hand. And later on, he said to his wife, he said, you know, when I shook their hand, they looked me straight in the eye. And he said, that's an example of good training. Well, I've dropped a lot of balls, but at least maybe I got that one right, you know? And so I was very proud to hear that. It's a skill. Personal discipline. Can you say, I won't do this, even though I can get an immediate reward for right now? Because if I put it off and wait, I can get a better reward down the road. Can we teach our children discipline? Do they have those personal discipline skills? Perseverance. Most of the conversation that I've had with my son Jeremiah over the last 2 months is persevere. Hang in there. Don't say, I don't think I can take this anymore. Because if you can't take it, nobody else will. And you have a wife and you have a son. You have to persevere. I'm here for you. Your mother's here for you. We will do whatever we can, but we want you to persevere, to be strong. Independence. Have we taught our children independence? If something happened to us, could our children, you know, if something happened to me, could my children make it? Could they find their own way? Or are they still too dependent on me financially or whatever? Independence. A positive legacy. What do you want people to say about your life? Do you really know who you are, or are you what everybody else says you ought to be? Do you know who you really are, or are you what everyone else thinks you ought to be? I mean, that's the life of the average middle school kid right there. So look, you can see the list here, and those are sort of like, you know, offsetting. Are you independent, dependent, positive legacy, family embarrassment, whatever you are. But these are really important. And these are dad words. They're mom words too, but these are really important dad words that they should leave with their children. You have, look, men, you have such an important office. Women too, but I already talked about women, so I'm talking to men right now. You have such a crucial office. And I'm telling you that so much of the slide that we've experienced in our culture today is because too many men did not show up, or if they did, they did too little. And they got distracted, or they found other things to do, or they didn't deal with their issues. They didn't make the Lord a priority, whatever it was. And I'm saying that, you know, we can't control what the rest of the culture does, but this church can control what it does. You as men can control what you do. And maybe in our own little corner of the world here, we can begin to turn the corner at least a little bit and make a substantive difference. If you are a dad, if you are an uncle, if you are a grandfather, you can make a difference in these kinds of ways, and you should, because this is your office. This is your God-given office, and these are the things that not only does God expect of you and me and us, but it's what the world desperately needs, even though the world says we don't need you in that way. And I hope that you will accept that as a challenge and make a difference in your life in that way. I'm sorry I went so long, but I hope you get my heart on this and how important it is in all of our lives.